when Joe invited me to contribute to this workshop, thanks Joe, I agreed because the concepts of activism and integrity and the Conservative Party intrigued me. I confess that my initial thoughts were not scholarly. Activism during Cameron's premiership was amusing, whilst integrity provided too many opportunities for Ewer to ignore. I wondered how Neil Hamilton would react to a request for another interview, but this time on the issue of integrity to the extremes. I was also a little perplexed. As a typical empiricist, I often sidelined abstract theory in favour of evidence. However, I quickly realised that these concepts are not alien at all to the study of the Conservative Party, but were instead constant features throughout my study of its relationship with the extreme right. Therefore, I think the best way that I can contribute to this workshop is to look at examples where integrity became an issue for Conservatives and resulting activism. This will probably generate more questions than it answers, mostly because of my own limitations. But I hope that by doing so, to provide some possibilities for research. The areas that I look at, which are the post-Second World War, Atlean settlement, decolonisation, race and immigration, allow us to consider a number of questions such as why an issue resulted in increased activism, how the notion of integrity played a role in the activism, whether activism was linked solely to the political arena, how integrity manifested in the activist discourse, how far activists were prepared to go to protect their integrity, and finally, how useful potentially are the concepts of activism and integrity in studying conservatism. Now, I'm going to be putting up a few slides shortly, and they're going to contain some words of usually the activists or some of the activists themselves, and I hope that by doing so you'll see the different levels of integrity, shall we say, different types of integrity at play. Okay, the 1945 general election resulted in a new paradigm for Conservatives. Britain's first majority Labour government with a landslide to protect it allowed the creation of the National Health Service, the expansion of social housing, implementation of the Beveridge Report to provide a cradle-to-grave welfare state and extensive nationalisation. This was anathema to many Conservatives. It struck at the individualistic element injected into the Conservative Party by its absorption of free trade liberals in the early 20th century and its traditional stance of maintaining the status quo. However, what really inflamed some Conservatives was a party leadership wide-ranging policy review which culminated in 1947 in the publication of the Industrial Charter, in which the Conservative leadership just accepted Labour's reforms. The result was activism driven by what the activists saw as a personal integrity, compelling them to act according to their conscience, and was evident in their criticisms, suggesting that the party leaders had no integrity. For example, Sir Walden Smithers, a Conservative MP, stated at the 1947 party conference, "There can be no compromise with socialism or communism. You must let the Conservative Party become infected with a socialist bug. The Conservatives must stick to its principles or perish." Smithers asked the conference to save the Conservative Party and England by rejecting the Industrial Charter. In effect, he implied that the Conservative Party was betraying not only party, but also nation. Others denounced the party leadership. In 1948, the leader of the British Housewives League castigated Churchill and his shadow cabinet for accepting Labour's National Insurance and Health Service Act, which he described as a terrible infringement on freedom and a totalitarian act. Now, this was a particularly cutting remark to someone seen by many as one of the few Conservatives with integrity, Churchill, for his pre-war and wartime actions. But it was also, like that of Smithers, a criticism based on a new definition of integrity in the post-1945 world. Sometimes the Conservative Party acted when it felt its integrity was threatened. One prospective parliamentary candidate described the Labour government as that group of national traitors, that hierarchy of semi-alien mongrels and hermaphrodite communists that have the impudence to call themselves that which they are not, a British government. Conservative Central Office withdrew party support from him straight away. But as bad as the charges of betrayal and deviance were, which again, another form of integrity, it was a racist term, semi-alien mongrels, that especially worried a Central Office determined to avoid anything that would allow its opponents to highlight its pre-war connections with Nazis and fascists. Again, this was a new strand of integrity. Central Office consistently opposed individuals and groups such as the New Crusade and the Guild of Good Neighbours, whose anti-Semitic and racist activism could damage the post-war integrity of the party. One of these groups that emerged during this period, Clan Britain, brings us on to our next topic of decolonisation. British Conservatives believe in constitutional monarchy, in which the monarch and parliament acting together are the best guarantors of order. The fruits of this relationship peaked in the late 19th century when Disraeli made Queen Victoria the Empress of India. Thereafter, empire was central to Conservative notions of their and Britain's identity. It became a useful tool when this party of the propertied face the prospect of mass democracy. Lord Salisbury used imperialism to attract the newly enfranchised working classes with promises of sustained employment. Empire shaped the party's positions on tariffs and even brought Britain close to civil war when Andrew Bonar Law opposed the Third Home Rule Bill in 1912. Therefore, it is not surprising that when a Conservative Prime Minister expressed his delight at the outcome of the Battle of Britain in 1940, he chose to do so in terms that not only justified the British Empire's finest hour, but also expressed a belief in its longevity. In other words, the Battle of Britain was a supreme test of British Empire's integrity. Consequently, when decolonisation began soon after the Second World War, it undermined what some Conservatives perceived as the integrity of the British Empire. Typifying such a Conservative was a Mr. L.N. Tomlinson, who formed Clan Britain after India gained independence and before the 1951 general election. Tomlinson claimed that Attlee's government was devoted to the destruction of empire. Like the aforementioned PPC, Tomlinson combined questioning the Labour government's integrity with other criticisms that were problematic for the post-1945 Conservative Party. He stated that, "Today, our life is impregnated with the breeders of greed, jealousy, corruption and self-glorification who are all too often non-Christian, of alien blood, interested only very superficially indeed in the well-being of Britain and Britons. Their loyalties are to themselves alone, and the parasite occupations which find them wealth at the expense of the British people who have given them sanctuary." Question the integrity of people who should owe something to Britain. Outwardly, the Central Office nonchalantly dismissed Tomlinson as a semi-fascist, whatever that is. Racism without the jackboots, I suppose. However, when they discovered he was an office holder in a local Conservative association, his views also questioned the party's integrity towards the new paradigm. This resulted in a marked change of attitude in Central Office, and inwardly it took as much action as possible to limit the harm he could do. But they were not nonchalant when faced with Conservative activism that was larger, better resourced, intellectually stronger, and with many links to the Conservative Party. This particular activism worried Central Office not just because of the nature of its membership, but also because it questioned the party's integrity over policy implemented by successive governments under Churchill, Eden and Macmillan that led to a substantial reappraisal of British identity. This was because decolonisation resulted in higher black immigration, which put race at the forefront of the discourse about identity. This increased activism came from a group called the League of Empire Loyalists. On its Grand Council were people whose status meant the utmost integrity. These included Lord Ironside, Chief of the Imperial General Staff, the Earl of Buchan, Lieutenant General Sir Balfour Hutchinson, and other high-ranking Colonel Blimp-type individuals. However, the League of Empire Loyalists also contained former members of British Union Fascists and overt anti-Semites. This included their leader, A.K. Chesterton, who had left the British Union Fascist because he was insufficiently anti-Semitic.
Because it was.
Mm. Chesterton questioned the Conservative Party's patriotic integrity by contrasting Churchill's pre-war commitment to empire with the decolonisation policy of his government. Sir Winston, after all his brave words, now presides over the liquidation of the British Empire, but so potent is the alchemy of his mind that no doubt he persuades himself that the process is really one of wafting the empire to the sunlit uplands of his wartime imagining. It's strange in a way that although he's clearly implying that he's a bit of a hypocrite, a lot of hypocrite, he doesn't seem that he can criticise too far in that it gives him some integrity, but anyway. But I also want to consider three other aspects of the League of Empire Loyalist activism. How its members' belief in their integrity led them to unacceptable activity, whether Chesterton moderated his words in light of the changed circumstances of the post-war period, or even changed his opinion as to who was responsible for it and of things like decolonisation, and lastly, how the Conservative Party, in an effort to maintain its integrity, was willing to compromise it. The League of Empire Loyalists became notorious for its stunts. Initially, these were quite benign. In 1956, during the first visit to the UK by a Soviet Union leader, League of Empire Loyalist members delivered a wreath to number 10 Downing Street commemorating those killed under communism, with a 10-foot-long silver spoon for Prime Minister Eden just in case he couldn't get the message. But their activities became more worrying. League of Empire Loyalist members interrupted Eden's speeches, with one female member hiding backstage and walking on during Eden's speech to protest, even assaulted the Prime Minister at a public event. Some even broke into the BBC programmes to denounce the government's decolonisation policy on radio and television, which strikes me quite similar to what you were saying before, Joe, about what you say, performative spaces. Yeah. Therefore, League of Empire Loyalist members were prepared to break the law and receive convictions for their principled stance. Nor did Chesterton moderate this language. For Chesterton, the Conservative government's dismantling of the empire was treason. Beyond doubt, it is treason to dissipate the heritage of 1,000 years, to destroy the values which those 1,000 years have created, and prepare to hand over the sovereign right to our obedience. These words focus on the narrow topics of characteristics of patriotism and imperialism, which many Conservatives believe were part of British identity. They question the integrity of the Conservative government, whilst at the same time, of course, implicitly juxtaposing it with the unsullied integrity of the League of Empire Loyalists. However, integrity was visible in other ways in Chesterton's writings. Initially, it appeared that Chesterton might acknowledge the post-Holocaust world. He adopted euphemisms for his anti-Semitism, such as the New York money power, and claimed that the term fascism was no longer applicable after 1945. However, in Chesterton's Sound the Alarm books, which was a serious warning about the dismantling of the British Empire, the words were actually riddled with overt anti-Semitism of the type found in the anti-Semitic forgery, The Protocols of Zion. In this series, Chesterton blamed the Jews for the fall of the Bourbons, the Habsburgs, Romanovs and the Nolazolans, the outbreaks of the First and Second World War, the creation of international organisations such as League of Nations, United Nations, NATO, CETO, the Warsaw Pact and the Common Market. In short, Jews were responsible for all the world's problems. He's sticking to his own personal integrity, of course, to anti-Semitism. However, he was also open to considering other threats to British identity. The League of Empire Loyalists quickly became the home to a bunch of neo-Nazis and racialists. For those people, the integrity of the British Empire was synonymous with white rule. One example was Major General Richard Hilton, a decorated veteran of the two world wars, who had received the formal surrender of the German forces in Norway before becoming a military attaché in Moscow. His idea of activism was also attacked the Conservative government's integrity over decolonisation, both in print and in speeches to the young Conservatives. But for Hilton, the core of Britishness was not simply a matter of culture, values or institutions, because all of those could be adopted by immigrants. Instead, Britishness was about skin colour. He argued that even if a Jamaican adhered to the proper rules and mores of British society, this does not and never can make him British by race. It's a very uncompromising form of integrity. Chesterton readily accepted this new scapegoat. An issue of skin colour in British identity went on to form the ideological core of Britain's first post-war far-right party, the National Front, and I would argue its successor, the BNP. Chesterton was the National Front's first leader, and its activists included, of course, people like Hilton and other former League of Empire Loyalist members such as John Bean, John Tyndall, Colin Jordan, and the anti-Semitic Conservative, prospective parliamentary conservative at Chorley, a chap called Andrew Fountain. The Conservative Party's response to the League of Empire Loyalists is interesting because it reveals how far it was prepared to go to maintain the party's integrity and what it saw as being at the core of that integrity. Initially, Central Office tried to see off the League of Empire Loyalists by highlighting its fascist antecedents. But it quickly stopped this after Chesterton sued any publication carrying such a comment. He won all the cases, by the way, and threatened to expose the Conservative Party's connections to interwar fascism. Thereafter, Central Office used its area agents to identify League members within the party and put pressure on them to either cancel membership of the League of Empire Loyalists or leave the Conservative Party. Central Office also used its business and social connections to exert pressure. Its area agents used their connections within various industries to identify League of Empire Loyalist members, for example, the insurance industry, and warn them of the consequences of their actions. And League of Empire Loyalist members found themselves pressurised and even ostracised at places like Gold Club. Again, it's that performative space. Central Office was even prepared to skirt with illegality. Its stewards used violence against League protesters at the 58 party conference. This resulted in criticism in Conservative publications such as The Spectator and The Telegraph, and a flurry of angry letters to Central Office from party members who witnessed the violence. When the League sued, citing a Conservative Party member as a chief culprit, Central Office provided a legal deposition denying all of the League of Empire Loyalist claims, its accusations of what Central Office had, despite having substantial evidence to the contrary. Therefore, it is clear that for Central Office at least, activism was only acceptable if it did not threaten the party's espousal of democratic views and principles it wanted to portray to the electorate. However, this became much more difficult to ensure when an increased pace of decolonisation resulted in a challenge for winning the party to this commitment and to its institutional integrity. This challenge came from the Monday Club. Formed in response to Prime Minister Macmillan's Winds of Change speech in Victoria on Monday 3rd of February 1961, the Monday Club was one of the most active and influential post-1945 Conservative groups. Its economic policy, for example, became party policy. The notion of integrity is present in many forms of its relationship with the Conservative Party. The Monday Club's correspondence with Central Office over Rhodesian independence in the mid-1960s contained many examples of it. It described the party leadership's willingness to side with the Labour government over black majority rule as a betrayal of our kith and kin. Instead, Monday Club members wanted a new Rhodesian constitution wherein power does not pass to the majority race, but is just to all races. Monday Club members claimed this was a position of integrity, which was informed by the traditional conservative paternalism. In other words, the white man should continue civilising the black man until he was fit to govern. The problem was, of course, that Monday Club members were never able to give an idea of when the situation would arise. This questioned whether it was integrity to the white man's burden, the so-called price of empire, or racism that lay at the heart of the Monday Club's position. And I'm going to suggest that there's plenty of evidence to show it was the latter. What these comments also show is that the struggle over defining British identity was playing out within the Conservative Party as well as outside it. Of course, race is not the only area that played a part in the discourse about British identity within the Conservative Party. Other issues have played a role, such as religion, maiden aunt cycle to church, cricket and village greens and warm beer. Yet, none has been as potentially dangerous as the issue of race that lay behind these comments. And it was a Monday Club supporter who brought it to the forefront of British politics and cemented it there. Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech, warning of the consequences of black immigration, was also inspired by what he saw as a lack of integrity by the Conservative leadership to Britain's identity. But it was also a criticism regarding integrity to future generations. His problem was that facing him was a party leadership that argued for what it saw as a higher form of integrity, the responsibility of a fading imperial power to those who held British citizenship and to broader notions of democracy such as equality. Powell's comments unarguably gave the Monday Club a boost. They made him politician of the year 2 years running in recognition. It also resulted in an increase in membership for Chesterton's National Front. Connections between the National Front and the Monday Club grew. The National Front infiltrated the Monday Club's branches, which of course threatened the Conservative Party's embarrassing pre-war connections with fascism coming to the fore. Central Office believed that the Monday Club was actually trying to effect a takeover of the Conservative Party from within. Therefore, if the National Front succeeded in their infiltration of the Monday Club, the consequences for the Conservative Party in British politics were dreadful. Both organisations had asked Powell to lead them. His acceptance would have provided the far right with something they have lacked since the mid-1930s, a credible, charismatic leader. And Central Office's reaction to this possibility showed just how far it was prepared to go to stop this threat. In 1973, the Monday Club chairman, Jonathan Guinness, was the official Conservative candidate at the Lincoln by-election. At a meeting before the election, the Conservative Party chairman invited Guinness to Central Office. There, the party chairman implemented a carefully constructed plan, worked out well in advance, to threaten Guinness that if he did not stop this infiltration, it would be difficult for the party organisation and for your colleagues to give their wholehearted and committed support to you in Lincoln, both during the election campaign and in the longer term. And for a Conservative Party chairman to threaten its own candidate was a remarkable event, and I have not come across a single similar example in the party archive. I admit I've not seen it all, but I've seen quite a large chunk of it. And the plan worked. Guinness did remove extremists, and the party chairman had maintained the Conservative Party's integrity regarding its commitment to democratic norms and, of course, more cynically, its integrity to its goal of winning elections. So, what conclusions can we draw from these examples? I admit they are not numerous in this presentation, but if I told you there were well over 300 such groups that operated on the Conservative Party's right-wing border from 1945 onwards, you'll see that there's plenty of scope for using these concepts to investigate various things. Therefore, we can conclude that the party is a rich seam for the integrity project to mine, I also accept that the aspects of integrity mentioned have been, of necessity, no more than in a way two-dimensional accounts as perceived by the Conservative Party leadership and dissident Conservatives. Nevertheless, they do show the causal role that integrity played in activism, the persistence of integrity as an issue for activists, and how they used it in their discourse. Moreover, these examples show how integrity can lead to organisations engaging in actions that questioned integrity in other areas, so there's a gradation of integrity, many forms of activism and integrity. However, I'm going to end with a few comments about other ways in which studying conservatives and conservatism might benefit from using these concepts of activism and integrity. Studying conservative activism and integrity is problematic, mainly because there is a desire for power of a political party, which obviously casts a veil over the truth. Perhaps then, activism might be a useful tool to distinguish between political expediency and integrity, even if that might ignore the general held belief of us. It's a difficult one. For many, though, conservatism is not an ideology in the senses in which socialism and liberalism are. Instead, it's a pragmatic state of mind, wherein individuals desire to preserve the status quo. Consequently, they become very active only when they believe that the status quo is threatened. Think UKIP. However, when society changes sufficiently to provide a new paradigm, the result is usually the acceptance of that new paradigm by most conservatives and a rejection of it by the minority. The discourse of this process, in terms of struggle against change and the acceptance and rejection of it, is usually accompanied by an increase in conservative activism, during which the notion of integrity plays a significant role. Therefore, I would suggest that activism and integrity could be useful concepts to understand the nature of conservatism.